You are listening to the Two Daft Yanks podcast. I am your host, Chad Smith, coming to you from the Mile High Two Daft Yanks studios. And joining me after a week off of the show for the both of us is a sleep-deprived Corey Chatelain in a yet unnamed TDY studio located somewhere in the deep south.
Yeah, I think we're going to go with the from the shadows of the Stone Mountain studio. It's got a nice ring to it.
Ooh, I like that. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so Southeast Atlanta, Southeast Atlanta area just outside, you know, about a half an hour drive. But yeah, I'm getting sleep deprived because, yeah, the 4 hour four hour time difference, I'm having trouble adjusting to it. I got in late, you know, the first night that I got here, and my sleep rhythms have been all screwed up since. So, you know, I'm kind of feeling the effects of like the Europa League hangover Thursday, Sunday thing.
Yeah, the Thursday, Sunday with that trip to Ukraine.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I kind of, you know, I knew cross country flights were tiring to begin with. But yeah, for some reason, I guess because, you know, it was my final trip, and actually moving back to the East Coast, it's definitely been a difficult few days with the sleep patterns.
Okay, well, we'll try to break you out of that rhythm, that cycle, with some footy talk as we are back to break down some summer international tournaments. So let's get the crowd fired up, Corey, and let's get going.
Yeah, just before you get started, we should try and find the guy who does the Coast to Coast intro for the Shadows of the Stone Mountain Studios.
We could probably hire that guy.
Yeah, so anyway.
With our vast budget that we do not have.
So that was one of the things I did one of the nights I couldn't sleep was come up with the new studio name. So, okay. Yeah. Settled on Shadows of the Stone Mountains.
Okay. Very good. So we will start the show with this, and I was thinking about starting the show with this, and then I saw Corey opine his opinion over the weekend about this very same thing. So I knew we would start the show with this, just a brief mention and a message that at the end of this club football season here in May, we were both kind of worn out and maybe a little leery of the quality of football that we would see this summer with these international tournaments. But I think we can both agree that these tournaments so far have been very good. And I definitely was get off my lawn guy at the end of the year, because I enjoyed the club football so much and we're so used to the international game, you know, ruining our club season with these meaningless friendlies that we forget how good these games that actually matter when the players are up for it are in these summer tournaments.
Yeah. And I agree. I've been very pleasantly surprised at both the Copa Centenario and the Euros. And, you know, as much as I've made fun of it for being a cash grab tournament, the Copa Centenario, that was more about where it's being held and how it was put together, not the actual idea of it. Because, you know, as I pointed out to somebody on Twitter the other day, you know, even the English league had a centenary league cup tournament once where they had like the top eight club teams from the previous season playoff for, you know, basically what amounted to a meaningless trophy. So it's not the concept. It was just how it was put together. But yeah, with that said, all the games have been pretty entertaining, and match to match comparison, the Copa Centenario first round has been more entertaining, much more entertaining than the Euros, in my opinion.
Really?
Yes. You know, the Latin teams have a way of turning even first round matches into just outright theater. Like I said, it's just when your team's not involved, that madness is, you know, it makes it even more fun.
That's true. I could see that too a little bit. And the Copa did get off to kind of a slow start. And maybe I would kind of point that towards. Remember, they're traveling here from up from South America, which is it's close, but it's still a hole. So I think a lot at first, maybe some of these teams who quite haven't got their feet settled in were battling the same effects you are.
Well, yeah, and one of the actual astute things that Fox pointed out was, you know, how many miles Messi's traveled, because again, they're not just coming from South America, but a lot of these guys had to go to Europe, to South America first, and then up here. So, you know, that's a good, you know, a good 8,000 to 12,000 mile, you know, travel when all is said and done.
Somebody on the Fox network made that point.
Yeah, I was surprised because, you know, Fox is basically like all their sports basically has descended into, you know, a de facto, you know, frat boy party. But yeah, I don't remember who it was. I just remember seeing the graphic because, again, it might have been one of those where I still had it on mute after Lawless went on one of his rants. But yeah, I just remember seeing the graphic. So I don't know who was talking. But again, I thought it was a pretty astute point. Because I think they were making the point of why Messi wasn't starting in the first few games. And, you know, he had traveled like 11,000 miles in the last 8 days or whatever it was.
And he suffered deep bruising to his back.
Yes.
Which is a – back injuries are nothing to laugh at, even minor ones, boys and girls. So, yeah, so I guess my main point was why I was kind of down – maybe on this summer, and I don't even know why I was down on the Euros. It's just the club season. I just enjoyed so much, as I said. But I was concerned about injuries and oversaturation of football, especially for the South American and North American players, right, who haven't had a summer off. You went World Cup. Last year you had a regular Copa America and a Gold Cup, and then this summer all these players are coming back for this special Copa America. So I was like, really, I thought maybe we might be pressing these athletes too much and they would come up here, play in this tournament, but not really put in a full effort. But that certainly has not been the case.
Well, and I think some of that may have been, or you know, some of us initially kind of not looking forward to the Copa America was, you know, when the rosters came out, a lot of the South American teams basically you know, announced that they were coming with, you know, what amounts to B or B plus sides. So, you know, there was that kind of connotation that a lot of the countries weren't going to take it seriously when, once the games start getting played, it's, you know, you're kind of reminded of, oh yeah, a lot of these countries, you know, they have more than 11 decent guys that can play. And a lot of these guys, you know, have come here, you know, basically to get themselves, or, you know, push themselves further up the pecking order in their national team setup. So I would kind of make the argument that maybe the B sides or the B plus sides is one of the things that's kind of helped the tournament.
Yes, no, that may be the case. And you have this added point that I wanted to make that kind of dovetails into yours, is the fact that with this tournament being held in the United States, I think that gives it a little more media play, especially to the world audience, because it's being played in the United States. And with the great media coverage that it is receiving, that these players and some of these chances, they're playing for a place to, you know, get in a permanent spot in the 11 of their country, but they're also looking for transfer moves, right? And so they're playing hard for that because, hey, a good Copa America showing against all these eyes can get you on the radar of a European club.
Yeah, because it's kind of like a, you know, certain titles on a resume or certain certifications on a resume. It's always going to look good regardless of what the actual, what the actual level is. So yeah, having a good Copa America on your resume, like you said, it's only going to be good things for certain guys, and especially some of the CONCACAF nations that have played well. You know, Panama, Costa Rica, or you know, Costa Rica's first match anyway. Those are definitely the ones that are definitely looking to make some money moves, even if it's not to Europe, you know, within North America or even South America.
Yes, those are good points. So I guess one thing here, how about a public service announcement?
Sure, why not?
You like those? I wish we had that, the, you know, the shooting star.
Yeah, the more you know.
One the more you know. Yeah, the more you know. Well, the more you know this week, folks, is ESPN versus Fox. Comparing the coverage between these two tournaments, and it's quite laughable. And I will say that if you're watching the Copa America in the United States and your cable package or your over-the-air cable package happens to have any of the Univision channels, the trade-off that you'll get by watching the game in Spanish versus what you'll get in English on Fox is well worth the it's well worth that trade-off, because A, you'll learn some Spanish, your Spanish will get a lot better, and you won't want to bash your head against the wall time after time after time. So Univision is your friend during this Copa America. Do not watch Fox. Don't do that to yourself. Have some self-respect.
Yeah, unless you like to watch Fernando Fiore subtly tell Lawless he's a moron, because that's been the one enjoyable thing about the Fox show, is Fiore's interactions with Lawless. Because again, I know some people don't like it. I know some people think it's kind of stupid, but I like when he hands out the card, you know, the cards in the studio. Because again, that's one of those, yeah, it's a joke, but I think there's more seriousness to that than a lot of people think when he hands out those cards. Basically, like I said, to me, he's subtly telling people they're stupid when they do that.
No, yes.
Even if it is in a joking manner, you know, I think there's a little more to it than just that.
Yeah, and the way
at least I'm interpreting it as such. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and the way he acts and the way he speaks clearly makes the rest of the people in the studio uncomfortable, which is pretty funny considering that, you know, Fox is a bunch of clowns, but a guy actually acting like a clown is making the clowns uncomfortable.
Well, yeah, and I think Fiore does, and again, I'm not saying we're at Fiore's level, but what I like about Fiore is he does what, you know, basically what we try to do, bring analysis with levity, but at the same time, there's, you know, legitimate points to what we're saying. It's just, you know, we don't want to be the cut and dried, boring over analysis that everybody does. But so, like I said, that's the thing I think Fiore does so well, is that, yeah, he's kind of goofy and, you know, a lot of people don't like him because he's, like I said, he's kind of silly and he does the card thing. But again, it's one of those that's what sets him apart, is that he knows what he's talking about and he can do it in a, you know, in a jovial and humorous manner.
Okay. And do we know anything about his background? Like where does he work during the rest of the year?
I don't know recently, but I know he was, I think he was part of the crew that replaced, when Andres Cantor left Univision's main broadcast team. I think he was one part of the crew that replaced him, but don't quote me on that.
Okay. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who can tell us. So if you know, hit us up on Twitter. And we have our brand new Twitter page all redesigned with some very professional looking stuff now. Looks great. I love the new Twitter page.
Yeah, I like the racing stripe.
Yeah, so hit us up at
Racing Stripe logo.
Yeah, at Two Daft Yanks, where we have our new avatar and we have our new header featuring what is it? Aguero, Harry Kane, and Aaron Ramsey.
Yeah. And Kane's on top.
But I did not design it. I try to tell Corey
the independent
designer did that on his own. I did not ask for Harry Kane to be on there. But yeah. I will tell the story just to show you that I was looking out for Corey. I told him this. The first design I got had De Gea on there. And I said, hey, I can't have a Spurs player on there and not an Arsenal player because Corey will go ape shit. So I said, please either put Peter Cech on there because he's a goalkeeper, or somebody else, and he came up with a nice design with Ramsey. So there you go. I threw you a bone.
Well, I wouldn't go apeshit, but, you know, I just, you know, it would go on a list. You know, I remember these things. You know, yeah, what can I say?
Conspiracy theory that you'd have.
With, that yeah, there you
fired against you and Arsenal.
There you go. And in light of the De Gea controversy of the last week, it worked out even better. So
that's
there you
a
go.
Great idea. Yeah, I thought he was going to get transferred, and he still may to prison. Right? Prison FC. Like, what was the big joke? Who was the guy? Somebody last summer got thrown in prison for, like, tax evasion.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I forgot. Yeah, but yeah,
I forgot. But the joke was, you know, so-and-so has been transferred to Prison FC on a free transfer.
Oh, well, there was, what's his face? The guy who got banned from, the Welsh guy. I forgot his name. The one that got arrested for or convicted of sexual assault.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. Yeah, that's not funny. Yeah, I wouldn't make that joke, but people were making that joke. But no, this
Chet,
guy was
Chet Evans.
That's yeah, it. No, not him. But this was somebody who got nailed on tax evasion and got sent to prison. Anyway, we're going to move on here to bigger and better themes. Let's talk about this Copa America in general. And we'll focus here. How crazy is this? If someone would have told you at the beginning of the tournament, Corey, that the United States would win their group and Brazil would get sent home, how hard would you laugh?
Pretty hard, considering, you know, I was pretty vocal about my expectations that we weren't going to qualify at all. So to somehow come out and win the group has obviously been pretty surprising. But there again, you know, that's kind of the beauty of having low expectations is, you know, you're generally more pleasantly surprised when the team you support does actually do something. So it's kind of been this past week and a half has kind of been what it must be like to be an English fan sometimes, as you go in with some of these low expectations. When they do something, like I said, you're kind of, oh, you know, pleasantly surprised. And that, you know, the one match, you know, where we, excuse me, where we held off to win 1-0 with 10 men, you know, that was pretty enjoyable. So, you know, been pleasantly surprised with how well we played.
Yes, and it also shows the beauty of competition, which we will focus on later in the show, and some other related objects. But I would say that it is kind of fascinating that we've done this because nobody really – well, I mean, some people, like, you know, your ardent MLS bot, these people were like, oh, when the draw came out, we were like, hey, this is going to be pretty tough. You got Colombia. Obviously, you saw what they did to us. I mean, we didn't play terribly bad. But we didn't create any chances and kind of were unlucky on both goals we scored, preventable. Then you had Costa Rica as a team that's given us trouble in the past, even though historically we've done well at home against them. It's on the road. So we had the advantage of being at home. And then Paraguay, who is kind of a team on the rise, and they kind of took a step back here. So coming into the tournament, there were people on our side who thought, hey, we're not going to do well enough because – our players aren't good enough. And then you have the other people on the other side thinking we're not going to do any good because Klinsmann's an idiot and he doesn't know how to set up a team. And it's kind of funny that really over the course of just three games here, both sides have been proven wrong.
Yeah. And I think to add to that point, some people kind of overreacted to losing to Colombia 2-0. And like you said, we didn't create many chances. Oh, by the way, Colombia is arguably one of the best teams in the world. So 2-0, even on home soil, in my opinion, again, I'm not trying to say that it doesn't matter, but I don't want to say that it's expected either. But again, 2-0 against one of the, at least on talent, one of the best teams in the world, it was kind of an expected result for me. So the fact that we didn't play that well didn't bother me that much because, again, you know, for all the talk of how far we've come in the last few years or the last decade or so, some of which on our part, that's still not the same as, you know, still being an actual elite team, even though you can, you know, compete with some of those teams now and then. So, like I said, that 2-0 win, I think some people kind of overreacted. But again, I would also preface that with I was also coming from a standpoint of not expecting to qualify anyway. So that result, that first result, like I said, didn't bother me too much. But again, I think showing the resolve in the second match, holding out, you know, for the victory with the 10 men. And I think it was either you or somebody else that I tweeted at that it actually looked like we really gave a shit in that match, which, you know, sometimes is also something that, you know, that maybe kind of turns me off about international soccer is that sometimes it looks like people don't necessarily give the effort, which, like you said, a lot of times has a lot to do with just being friendlies or kind of being a goal, you know, being in a gold cup where you're expected to crush some of these teams. So, but yeah, I mean, overall, you know, I never like to get into those kind of, oh, fire the coach, hire the coach. You know, what does this mean for the long term? Blah, blah, blah. But with that said, like I was said before, I've definitely been pleasantly surprised at how well we played in this tournament. And the draw is kind of setting up, you know, with Brazil being eliminated, it's kind of setting up that, you know, if we don't come out and lay an egg, we can maybe even make a run, you know, to the semi. Well, we'll make a run. It would win one game, but getting to the semis or maybe even the final. But again, if we were, nothing to do with, oh, what does this mean long term? Because again, I don't like to get into those kind of discussions because ultimately, you know, they're ever changing, you know, on tournament results.
Yes. Now you hit on a couple of things that I had written down that we wanted to talk about as the overreaction by some people, as you said, to that Colombia loss. And those some people would be your mainstream U.S. soccer journalist who were just crying bloody murder over a 2-0 loss to Colombia at home, which got Sunil Gulati the next day to come out and pretty much say, if Jurgen Klinsmann doesn't beat Costa Rica, he's going to get sacked, which was basically what he was saying. And everybody really took notice of that because Gulati usually doesn't speak in terms like that at all. And so he basically let it known that, hey, if we don't win this game and we're officially eliminated, well, then everything and anything's on the table. So it kind of shows you that, again, remember, these tournaments, you can't just base off one game. How many teams, if they lost the first game, pack up and go home, right? But it doesn't work that way. These are played over 3 games. It happens all the time. You can lose and you can come back. Now, it's difficult, and they did that. And so just your general thoughts on that quickly?
Well, just qualification in general is always much more difficult when you lose that first game. But again, playing a team like Colombia in the first game, again, that's one of those things that people kind of feign or people mistake things like, oh, well, MLS has come a long way and we're on home soil. Ergo, we should be very competitive with Colombia. When the simple fact of the matter is, regardless of where the MLS level is, we're still not on the level of a team like Colombia that's got several players that ply their trade in Europe and play in the Champions League. So, again, I don't understand why some of this is so difficult for some people that, yes, we've come a long way. It's on home soil. That's not the same thing as being as good as Colombia. So, I mean, again, some people are always going to be in that camp of you lose because they overestimate our own self-worth. Let's fire the coach. And again, I'm one of those people that, yeah, okay, let's fire the coach. You know, even if we fire a Klinsmann and hire somebody, that's not the same as fixing the real problems that we have in the game in this country. So, you know, again, it's one of those sometimes firing the coach is more about patting yourself on the back and making yourself feel better than actually solving the real issues of the game. So, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if I answered the question properly.
No, you did. Yeah, that's fine. No, I'm good. I'm good with what you said there. So let's. Yeah,
like I said, no matter what people think, we're still not as good as Colombia. So.
Okay. Now, and we'll hit on the second thing you said, which was that the players you thought gave a great effort in that match when we were down to 10 men. And it was. I mean, some people were saying, oh, you can't say it was heroic. I would say that it was because it showed for the first time. And throughout this camp, it showed that we actually finally now have a unity. The players have stopped fighting Jurgen because remember, pretty much through every camp I can remember since Jurgen's taken over, you would get these reporters with these off-the-record comments, right, of players being unhappy. And the big one would be like, oh, I'm being played out of position. And like Bedoya, I think last summer, was complaining, right, during the Gold Cup. Oh, I'm not a central midfielder. Well, guess what? He's played 3 games in a row. Central midfield. You know, where he had to drift out wide at times, especially in this third game. And I thought that was the key, is that we played a 4-3-3, but it really kind of developed into a 4-2-3-1. And that's what I'm trying to get these people to realize, and we talk about it all the time. Tactics are fluid, and you need smart players who could react to the situation and get into the proper shape. And I thought both Bedoya and Zardes, for the most part, as those wide players who, you know, got wide when we didn't have the ball, but were getting narrow and tracking back when we didn't have the ball, they both did excellent jobs. And the players are finally listening. Instead of fighting Klinsmann, they listened to him. And now we're turning in some of the best performances we've seen.
Yeah, and you want to get better, freaking can Zardes. I mean, because, yeah, he's done well defensively, but, man, he's just such a freaking like I described to somebody on Twitter a few days ago, he's never going to be more than that puppy that, you know, that gets so excited when he gets the ball. He just, oh, run. And half the time he trips over himself or he has the heavy first touch and loses the ball. But yeah, I mean, our thoughts on tactics are well known on this podcast. Like you said, they're fluid, they're ever changing. Formations have never been rigid in soccer to begin with, not in the sense of like American football. So yeah, it's one of those that's formations are definitely overplayed or the amount of mental effort that people put into lamenting about formations and setups in the modern game is definitely overplayed. Cause again, like, I'm still waiting for the answer for somebody to my question of if people aren't playing out of position, how do formations and tactics ever evolve? Why aren't we still playing in the 2-3-5, which, like I said, nobody wants to answer that. So, I mean, at some point, you know, versatility or you want your players not to be great in one specific thing, because then you end up being a specialist and you can't adapt your tactics because, oh, well, he's right footed. You got to play him on the right side. Well, you know, 20 years ago, everybody had out swinging corners. 20 years later, everybody does in swinging corners. You know, swapping wings is, you know, for years, why would you play an opposite foot player on the wrong wing? It doesn't make any sense. So, you know, again, I'm kind of off the point here, but yeah, so formation, people make too much of formations and people being played out of position, because at the end of the day, just like effort playing defense, there takes some effort into making a position change work as well. And a lot of times it doesn't work because the player doesn't put in the effort to make it work.
Yeah. So the players have started listening to Klinsmann and all the interviews, you talk about unity, and that's great to see. So now we got the players stop fighting Klinsmann. Now, if we could get just U.S. soccer to stop fighting Klinsmann, right? It makes no sense to me still that you're fighting the guy you hired from doing the things that he needs to do to further us as a footballing nation. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, well, and again, go back to the original thing that we said years ago when Klinsmann was hired. Klinsmann's hiring, and again, I know people like Lawless and Galati and those people want to hijack the conversation because, you know, power structures and, you know, people like Lawless are on TV and have a bully pulpit to yell at people to get their ideas across, you know, into the mainstream. But again, go back to our original point when Klinsmann was hired. Klinsmann's hiring was more about changing the paradigm of soccer in this country, and results are secondary. And I know people don't want to admit that because, you know, well, why would you be a fan if you're not going to try and win something? It's not about not trying to win something. It's about changing the structure of soccer in this country. And Klinsmann's hiring had more to do with that than how do we play against Costa Rica in Costa Rica and how come we lost to Jamaica and this and that. Yes, those things matter, but they're secondary no matter how much you actually want to admit that.
Yeah, I mean, numbers are numbers, and you can bend them. And people are like, oh, well, it doesn't matter. Well, you know, he's trying to do that, but as I said, getting fought every step of the way, which I hope will get cleared up here. But he also, and this is a fact, has the highest winning percentage of any manager in U.S. history. So he really is accomplishing both. As long as you don't have your agenda in the way.
Well, yeah, and detractors would say, yeah, but that's, a lot of that's boosted by friendly results. Well, okay, A, so what? Everybody plays friendlies. And B, double so what? Because, again, the results aren't necessarily his main thing. And a lot of times, like I said, the, we won't know if Klinsmann is an actual fail, a true failure or not 10 or 15 years down the road when if we're still not producing you know, enough young players that aren't into that elite level, you know, we won't know until then, because again, it's more about installing us, trying to install a system that helps us develop players in the long run, and less about, oh, losing to Jamaica in the World Cup or losing to Jamaica in the Gold Cup, which sucks. But again, it's secondary to the actual purposes of his hiring.
Yeah, and people are pointing to that Jamaica loss as a complete failure. But again, as I said, they say, well, he's only winning friendlies. Well, no, when you divide up friendlies and competitive matches, he has the best winning percentage in both categories.
Well, yeah, and regardless of whether it's a legitimate statistic or not, the one thing a lot of fans never want to admit to themselves, the other team tries a lot too, and they're also trying to develop. Yeah. You know, it's not just us. So again, that's the beauty of competition, is everybody's trying to make themselves better. And sometimes your methods work and sometimes they don't. Sometimes you lose to nations you quote unquote should beat, like Jamaica, and sometimes you don't. So obviously when there's the perception that you should beat a team, it's always going to come off bad, because, you know, most people's analysis basically amounts to, well, we're good in other sports and we're a big nation, we should beat nations like Jamaica. Meanwhile, Jamaica's got the best track program, you know, in the world. Meanwhile, Iceland, you know, all the talk of Iceland today, a nation of, you know, barely 500,000 people, and, you know, they're producing all these players. So like I said, a lot of times what people don't want to admit to themselves, because, you know, go home team, is the other team is trying a lot too.
You know, that's a point that you make often. But the other point I'll make is, so, I mean, listen to this. The Gold Cup was disappointing, but in other competitive arenas, this is what Klinsmann's accomplished. We won the Hex in qualification for the last World Cup. That's nothing to sniff your nose at, right? Especially when it's all about, hey, let's beat Mexico, right? He did that. Then he got us out of the group of death in the World Cup. And then, I mean, I guess it's arguable now, but he got us out of a very difficult group here in the Copa America. So I don't know. What do you want? So you're going to hold the Jamaica loss over his head? Because that's the really only major failure he's had. So if you're going to take that one game and say he's a failure because of that, well, then you're not being objective.
Well, yeah. Well, that falls in the category of how certain coaches get viewed. I'll invoke like the Les Miles thing. Whenever Les Miles does something good, oh, well, it's because Nick Saban installed the program, or, you know, laid the foundation for his success, and Les Miles just lucked into the shit because he's using, you know, stuff built by Saban. So it's kind of the same thing with Klinsmann. Whenever he does something good, whenever he accomplishes stuff more, well, it's because MLS is better now, or there's these ancillary reasons why he does well. And then when he fails against somebody like Jamaica, oh, well, there you go, Klinsmann's an idiot. It's like, well, maybe Klinsmann is an idiot, but at the same time, you do have to give credit where credit's due sometimes. And again, you know, how many wins in, you know, even if you, oh, they're only friendlies, how many wins in Europe did we have in friendlies before Klinsmann got here? Wasn't very many. You know, we hadn't won a game on European soil in almost 20 years before Klinsmann came. We won 3 or 4 in 1 year. Now, again, they're meaningless friendlies, but when you start doing stuff like that, like I said, as a program, even though you're still not necessarily winning titles, if you're raising the average, then again, that's a place to start. So like I said, to me, that's what a lot of the Klinsmann stuff comes off as being an LSU fan, is a lot of times Klinsmann gets thrown in the same kind of situations as Les Miles does, is that when he does do something well, it's always because of these ancillary or somebody else's work and not his work.
So, all right, let's wrap up here. We've gone a little longer than I wanted, but that's okay. Good discussion. And I just want to close out this Copa America US talk with what a lot of people are talking about now, but I noticed it in the very first game. And you can go back to our Twitter feed for proof if you really want to fact check me. But this emergence of John Brooks, where in the first game I said, hey, this guy is a completely different player than he used to be. He used to be a guy who used to switch off. He was a little positionally weak. But after a solid year here in the Bundesliga with Hertha Berlin, he has figured out the center back position positionally. And he is hardly ever out of position. And with his size and his athleticism and now with this newfound knowledge of the game, you could see him as one of the greatest center backs ever if he keeps on this path. Now, obviously, this is just one tournament, but the level of improvement we've seen from him just from last Gold Cup to this Copa America, I think, is off the charts.
Yeah, and I'm sure you meant best ever American center back.
No, he's the best ever, bro. USA number one. Yeah, Brendan, you name a center back, John Brooks will be better.
But, yeah, I mean, he was an and again, it was only one game, but again, he was an absolute monster against Costa Rica. I mean, he, you know, almost single, I shouldn't say single-handedly because Brad Guzan made several good saves too, but John Brooks won us that match against Costa Rica. I mean, after we went down to 10 men, we were basically, you know, reliant on him and Guzan.
You mean Paraguay?
Yeah, sorry, Paraguay.
Yeah. Yeah, you had me confused there for a second.
Yeah, sorry. Like I said, I'm sleep deprived all week, people. I'm get my stuff mixed up. But yeah, so he between him and Guzan, they basically saved our bacon in that match. And you know, I tweeted after that match that, you know, Brooks for the Iron Throne because he was an absolute monster in that match.
No, and he was. So hopefully that he can keep on this track. Again, he's still young, but he's 23, 24 years old.
Yeah, which for center back is pretty young.
Is young, and that's what I was going to say. I was like, you know, some of the best center backs we had, I guess recently, I guess you'd say Bocanegra, but he didn't really mature into a stud until he was, you know, into his late 20s and his early 30s. Gooch, I guess, was what, maybe in his late 20s when he got – pretty good, but then he had those injury problems. Other than that, I don't know. Other center backs you would like to toss out there? I can't think of too many off the top of my head.
Balboa. Cello.
And Balboa, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been a while. You forget about him.
And then what? Probably Thomas Dooley.
Yeah, Thomas Dooley, if you go way back. And he was a dual national too. Am I not right? Am I correct in that? Am I wrong?
Yeah, he came to us because he was like 27 and hadn't been capped by Germany.
Yeah. Yet. So, these dual nationals are terrible. Yeah. Oh, Abby Wambach. Ah, Thomas Dooley, get out of here.
Oh, call her by her proper name, Generalissimo Xenophobus of the police of the People's Republic of Alachuistan.
Yeah. But yeah. So I mean, we don't have a rich history. The bar of center back play in this country is actually pretty low. But for John Brooks to see this the way that he's playing here for club and country at such a young age is very, very – it's very good to see.
Yeah, and on Bundesliga players, I mean, who is by far our best forward right now? Bobby Wood, who plays in the second Bundesliga. So like I said, it's an example – or he's an example of how you don't have to necessarily be in a top league to still be in a better league – quality wise than MLS, because like I said, when you watch Bobby Wood play, and again, I'm not trying to compare him, you know, with true world class players or true top international quality players, but his movement is so much better than every other forward we have in the national pool at the moment. Now granted, he just got himself a move to Hamburg in the actual Bundesliga, so that kind of trumps a little of what I just said, but you know, my point is that he's developed that game playing a lot in the second Bundesliga and the third Bundesliga and the regional Liga levels. And that just because you're not in the top division doesn't mean that you can't develop and turn into a good national team player. Cause like I said, when you watch him play, his movement is miles better than every other forward in the pool at the moment.
All right, very good. So let's wrap up this Copa America talk with the TDY world famous gong, because we're going to move on. The gong has spoken. And our next topic of focus, of course, is the other international tournament that just started last Friday, hosted there in France, and that would be Euro 2016, Corey. And you just hit on the Iron Throne, which is good. And so we'll stick with that theme. And Euro 2016 in this expanded format, Corey, is showing that iron sharpens iron. Because you're seeing these so-called small teams who everybody said, oh, they can't compete in this new format. It's not so good. Well, guess what? They're competing. So let's run down the list here of teams who have showed very well so far as non-traditional European teams. Romania, opening game, did pretty darn well, I thought, against your host team, France. Albania was still in that game that whole time, even though they were down to 10 men for, what, almost 40 minutes, if not more.
Oh, yeah, it was the better part of an hour.
Yeah. Then you got Wales getting a win. First time in a major international competition since, what, the 1950s?
Yep, and they're beating England in their next match. Book it.
Yeah, you got Northern Ireland, only lost by a goal, and their return to the Euros. The Ukraine actually played pretty darn well. I mean, if they play like that against other teams, they'll get out of their group. But when you're going against Germany, I mean, losing 2-0 is no big deal. They had tons of chances. They had Germany pinned back there for most of that last part of that second half. Then you have today, Hungary beating Austria. Now, Austria's not great, but, you know, you haven't seen Hungary on the world stage in a long time. But and remember, a lot of you may not remember that back in the day, Hungary was a world power.
Yeah, Hungary was arguably the best team in the world in the early 50s.
Yes, with all kinds of great players. So if you don't, if you're not
the Magic Magyars.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with their history as a footballing nation, it is fascinating. The rise and fall of their footballing empire. And then again today, as you mentioned upon earlier, Iceland. Now, a lot of people are picking them to win, perhaps, but to get a 1-1 draw in their opening match against Portugal in the group they're in is a pretty good start.
Yeah, because just to touch up and finish on Hungary real quick. Hungary, you can make an argument that they fell off of the map mainly because of Soviet control.
Yes.
You know, when Soviet tanks rolled into Budapest. So just meaning that, you know, sporting-wise, Hungary, you know, at one time had a very good sports program because, you know, they're still arguably the best fencing program in the world. But yeah, so they fell off. And so main point being that just because you're good doesn't mean you're going to stay there. And sometimes, you know, there's extenuating circumstances, but a lot of times people fall off because they stagnate. Yes, so Iceland, I mean, anybody who watched Iceland play today, it was kind of humorous to watch some of the broadcasts because, you know, the counterattacking style, sitting back and playing counter is kind of in vogue now. But some of the announcers today were kind of like, or maybe it wasn't the announcers, maybe some of the people on Twitter, they were like, well, you know, for all the talk of Iceland, they're getting pinned back and they're sitting back and they're not playing that well, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, you know, they're only losing 1-0. If they can get into the break being down a goal, you know, they could reorganize and come out and play well, which they ended up doing. And they arguably should have won the match late. So it's kind of funny how, you know, for all the talk of some of the people who dislike possession, when it came to Iceland, and again, I don't know if it's because if it's a smaller nation, different interpretation kind of thing, the fact that they didn't have the possession, everybody was kind of like, oh, well, maybe this talk of Iceland was a little premature, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, because like I said, over the span of 90 minutes, and again, maybe I'm just have a anti-Ronaldo bias, but I think Iceland deserved – you know, maybe slightly deserve the 3 points more than Portugal did. Regardless, they definitely made a good showing for themselves. And to your point about the expanded tournament, I am kind of glad that ESPN, for some of their talk before the tournament, kind of, you know, piggybacking on some of the European media about, oh, well, the expanded format might water it down. To their credit, today, both Tirico and Steve McManaman, I know for sure, basically admitted that, yeah, the expanded format has actually helped the tournament. So it's kind of like what we talked about with Scott a couple weeks ago, that, you know, just because you expand something, it's not necessarily always watering down something.
No, that is the case. And I will say, yeah, the expanded format has worked out well, and it's going to make Europe all that much stronger, because think about this. So with this expanded format, that means that there's more opportunities for more teams when they have Euro qualifying from now on, which is going to make them better, which is going to make their World Cup qualification harder, which means once these sides get into the World Cup, you could argue that the World Cup is easier than the Euros. And so I think these teams are just going to be so battle-tested. You're not going to want to have too many European teams in your group.
Yeah, and like any format or system, it's not going to be, or you know, it's not going to be some magic silver bullet that automatic. You know, if you get through the process, it automatically means you're going to beat the other teams every once in a while. But it will prepare you for that tournament better than before, which I think is what your greater point is.
Yes.
And on the coefficient thing, I think we've talked about that before too, that now that you have more competitive, or, you know, what, now that you have what qualifies more for, you know, what FIFA and UEFA deem competitive matches, that's going to boost, you know, some of these countries' FIFA coefficients too, which inevitably boost, you know, Europe's overall coefficient, you know, which is going to matter for things like seeding, you know, when it comes down to it. So I think these expanded tournament, or you know, I think the European expanded tournament may actually force, or you know, one of the unintended consequences, I think, may actually force the Gold Cup and Copa America to eventually merge into one, you know, North combined America's Cup, more than just, you know, an anniversary tournament. At least if the administrators are paying attention, I think it should eventually force that.
And that is the big rumor out there. Now, everybody's denying it, but the reports are that discussions, they're saying, well, discussions haven't taken place, but everybody's saying, well, they are. After this Copa America, those discussions to get this on the calendar as on a regular basis is going to happen. And it has to, because, and not to pat ourselves on the back, but we predicted this. Remember when the EuroLeague?
No, go ahead and pat ourselves on the back. Yeah, we're right about a lot of this. No, kind of stuff.
That Nations League, when they announced that, I said, well, the only way for the rest of the world to compete with that, because remember, Europe is pretty much doing away with friendlies here soon. And they're starting the Nations League, which is going to be a promotion and relegation league within Europe, to where they're going to be playing competitive matches over, I think, is it three levels, four levels, where they're going to have promotion and relegation between the nations. And so they're not going to be playing friendlies anymore. They're going to be playing in this Nations League. And you're right, the only way for the other nations to compete with that, and we said it right away, was that North America and South America need to find a way to work together to strengthen the quality of play in the Americas, because the chances to play European sides in friendlies is going to be few and far between. So the fact that this is happening is not a surprise to us, because when it first happened, what, 2-3 years ago when they announced it, we said, hey, this is your natural way to compete against that.
Well, yeah, because even besides the obvious competitive standpoint that a combined tournament, you know, would create, just from a financial standpoint, I mean, you know, one of the worst kept secrets in the world is that the United States, people around the world are actually starting to learn that, hey, those Yanks not only know what, a lot of those Yank fans not only know what they're talking about, but they crave all forms of soccer. So, like I said, one of the worst secrets in the world is this market for soccer. So from a South American standpoint, it's only going to be natural that because of your proximity to North America, there's money to be made there in a North American market. So again, one of the things, and again, I don't care, no matter what it is, I don't care what people say, it's people's actions that matter. And you can guarantee, and again, I know they're not going to come out and tell you this, but you can guarantee one of the reasons why this Copa Centenario included North American tournaments or North American CONCACAF teams. This is a test run for the combined tournament that you're talking about, because again, those South American countries and the South American clubs eventually want to get into the North American market because of the proximity and make even more money than just selling players to Europe. Because again, it only makes sense that inevitably, you know, if a B level player can't make it in Argentina or Brazil, maybe he can go, you know, get on with an MLS team or something. So like I said, it's not just from a competitive standpoint that a combined Americas tournament makes sense, just from a financial standpoint and the future of how the game's going, you know, to where, you know, everybody's going towards, or, you know, gearing tournaments and things up towards financial markets and stuff anyway, that it only makes sense that, you know, that there eventually is a combined Copa Americas tournament.
Yes. And you make good points there, but I don't know if you saw this, but earlier in the week, a friend of the show and a featured guest on here, at least a couple times a year, the one and only Bobby McMahon, has a new money-based article on Forbes about soccer. Have you seen this? He's just started it maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago.
You know, I did not.
Okay, but he has the numbers this week. So you talk about – now, we joked about the Copa America being a money grab, and it is from the standpoint that you're going to make more money in North America than South America. But listen to these staggering numbers. He points out that these Euros, this tournament this summer, is worth $2.2 billion. And he doesn't go into the big numbers of the Copa America, but he does say that, and you talk about the payouts, right? Listen to this. The last place team in the Euros is going to make more money than the winner of the Copa America. Think about that.
Yeah.
And that comes from Bobby here. So he says the winner of the Copa America is set to make $6.75 million throughout the tournament, whereas the last place team in the Euros is going to make $9 million. That's pretty crazy to think about that.
And that has a lot to do with, you know, European markets and where the money in the sport are. You know, I mean, it's not where the money in the sport is. I mean, it's not a coincidence that, you know, Brazil exports, you know, some 2,000 to 3,000 players a year or whatever it is, you know, at all age levels. And where do they end up? You know, despite the emerging markets of Japan and China in the last decade, the vast majority of those players go to Europe. And even if they end up in places, you know, like Bulgaria, they're making more money than they would at home in Brazil.
Yeah. So it shows you that financially, that the gap between here and Europe obviously is huge as well. And that's the only way you're going to be able to compete with them in the end is money, right? Because money is everything. If we start playing at high European levels, then European players will come here to play. Or anybody will, not just European players, but I mean the top players in the world. So I guess that's the overall point there. And the fact that the two tournaments have such a big gulf that you could finish in last place in the Euro out of 24 teams, and you'll still make more money than whoever wins the Copa America. So that's pretty interesting. And yeah, I don't know. Any other final thoughts on any of that stuff?
No, other than, like I said, it only makes sense that eventually North and South America combined. You know, even if that means, you know, you might have to cull the Caribbean countries and, you know, maybe the Caribbean nations get their own federation, kind of like Oceania. Because, you know, in a combined North and South America, or, you know, in a combined CONCACAF-CONMEBOL federation, I'm not sure if a you know, how often that, you know, Caribbean nations could compete. With that said, like I said, to me, it's just inevitable because, again, long-term financially, that's the only way that I see personally for even traditional soccer powers like South American countries to compete with the Europeans because of what you said, that now even in non-Euro qualifying and World Cup qualifying years, they're going to have the Nations League. So Europe is going to be – their international football is going to be, you know, nonstop competitive tournaments. So, like I said, inevitably – South America, North America is going to have to do something just to, you know, just to avoid, you know, the saying of, you know, if you're, you know, standing still is falling behind. So, like I said, they're going to have to do something eventually.
All right. And let's end this European segment with some levity. And that is you opined to me during the German Ukraine match that the German coaching staff looked like what?
They just looked like they were, you know, kitted out like a 80s synth pop band.
That's right. And that's why I came up with a new band that hopefully he'll do. But Yogi, I know some people took offense to call him Yogi, but I mean, people have been calling that for a while. Right. Joachim, is that his real name?
Is it Joachim or is I thought it was Jurgen? But yeah, maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. But Yogi Low. And so I came up with, he said it was an 80s synth pop band, which got me to think of ELO, and I converted that into EL Low. So he is the front man of EL Low.
ELO with their hit single, Don't Bring Me Down, Mesut, you know, because everybody hates Ozil.
Yeah, Don't Bring Me Down, Mesut. And of course, everybody saw the now viral video of old Joachim in his ELO outfit, putting his hand down his pants, you know, checking out the old dingleberries and then having a little snifferoo, which is like, wow.
Yeah. Taking a whiff of the vintage. yeah. I don't know. I guess when you win the World Cup, you can kind of do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah. You're like, I guess so. But yeah, I mean, he's got to know, right? That there's cameras on him at every point in time, at every angle.
You would think that's why, like I said, that's why it makes me think. It's like, screw it. I won the World Cup. I can do what I want.
I'm going to scratch my nuts.
Yeah.
Take a whiff. And you know what? You don't like it? You could kiss my World Cup trophy.
Yeah. You know, it was definitely one of those when I saw the picture or when I saw the GIF, it was a, yeah, that's kind of interesting. I'm not sure what he's doing there.
Yeah. Oh boy, yeah, interesting for sure. So I don't know, some of you may think we're childish for bringing that up, but that
churlish even.
Yeah, that, but that is our unofficial This Week in Daftness. I couldn't be, it doesn't deserve theme music, so we won't play it, but there you go. This Week in Daftness.
Well, I was gonna say it's the unofficial Week in Daftness, but it's not official because you didn't want to insult the English announcer lady.
Yes, it would be. She would be very appalled if she had announced such a segment. Yeah, she would quit.
Yeah, so, you know, there you go. World champ, you can sniff your nuts in the middle of a stadium like, you know, like it's cool.
So, all right, boys and girls, we'll enjoy the Euros the rest of this week here. Tons more group stage action to take place. And then starting up here will be the knockout stages of the Copa America and, of course, the United States. We'll play in Seattle on Thursday night against Ecuador, which will be a tough match. They're all going to be tough from this point on. So, but good to be up in the Northwest. We should actually have a home crowd out for once.
Yeah, although, you know, Ecuador, multiple players in the Premier League, you know, I still think they're going to be favorites. But, yeah. Unlike the whoever scheduled the Haiti match in Seattle or Haiti's opening match in Seattle, dropped the ball. Yeah, for once, I think we did a good job of having, you know, the United States. Not that they purposefully scheduled that. It just worked out that way.
Yeah.
But being in Seattle is definitely going to help.
So, all right. So enjoy that. And we'll be back next week to either talk about a upcoming semifinal match or the heartbreak and the Jurgen Klinsmann out group, surely regaining their voice if we happen to lose. So be back here for the Two Daft Yanks podcast, and we will continue this summer of footy. So for Corey Chatelain, I am Chad Smith saying see you guys next week.
This has been the Two Daft Yanks podcast. If you like the show, be sure to find the Yanks at TwoDaftYanks.com or at Two Daft Yanks on Twitter. There, you can stay up to date on all the Two Daft Yanks action by subscribing to the show.